A Christmas Carol was written by Charles Dickens in a 6-week flurry of inspiration. The story goes that upon visiting the industrial city of Manchester, Dickens was moved to write a tale that he hoped would help improve conditions for the poor, especially children. He hoped also to revive his career, which had fallen into a bit of a slump. He hurried it to publishers in early December 1843, and it came out in print on December 19th. It has never been out of print since. The tale of Ebenezer Scrooge is so familiar to us that it has become tradition. It has been adapted for stage, screen, ballet, and it is practically required that television sitcom characters undergo permutations of it to suit their sitcom lives. It has been richly parodied and handsomely produced again and again. It is partly responsible for turning Christmas into a day of merriment. Dickens is credited with adding elements of celebration like the gathering of family for feasting, dancing, and games. But he had found precedent in Washington Irving's The Sketchbook of Geoffrey Crayon, Gent, which was published 20 years earlier. In it, Irving wrote warmly of the English Christmas traditions that he enjoyed while staying at Aston Hall. Like Irving, Dickens hoped that a festive season would do everybody some good. Music Theater for Young People is putting a musical version of A Christmas Carol on stage at Century 2. You can catch the show from December 9th to December 11th.
Support for this podcast comes from the Monarch in historic Delano, featuring over 250 craft bourbons and whiskeys, available neat or in a seasonal cocktail. Full bourbon menu at monarchwichita.com.
And we welcome you to On Stage, talking today about A Christmas Carol. I'm Fletcher Powell here, of course, with Sanda Moore Coleman. Hi, Sanda.
Hi, Fletcher.
And you tell us a little bit at the beginning about the context surrounding the creation of A Christmas Carol, but could you go a little more into that? What were the times like for Dickens that caused him to decide this is what he wanted to pursue?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that at the heart of the story, it's a redemption tale. And I think I would argue that all good literature is about redemption, the looking for it, sometimes achieving it, sometimes not. I think because I think that's a very human need to believe in the possibility for change. I definitely see parallels between our society, which is in the midst of the technological revolution, and the society that Dickens grew up in, which was the Industrial Revolution.
And as we know, of course, the Industrial Revolution, something that informed a lot of Dickens' work.
He wrote about it in every single thing he wrote about, every single book he wrote about that was underlying it. Because, I mean, we all know that Dickens had a difficult childhood. When he was 12, he went to work in a blacking factory to prevent his father from going to debtor's prison. And although he worked long hours in these unregulated, unsafe conditions, he made so little money that he was unable to prevent that, which, you know, must have been horrifying for him. So his father went to debtor's prison. He continued to work in these absolutely miserable conditions. 3 years later, when his father was released from prison, Dickens went back to school. 3 years later, his father was back in debtor's prison. And that's when Dickens quit his formal education for good. He found work as a legal clerk that took him to court reporting and then journalism and, of course, then eventually fiction writing. Mm-hmm. And by the time he was 24, he was a well-known writer. But he never forgot the experiences of that. And in fact, it became a real social issue for him. He was not the only person involved in social change that was brewing. Benjamin Disraeli wrote mm-hmm. Sybil. Charlotte Bronte wrote Shirley. And those were called industrial novels. They were the Condition of England novels, the State of the Union, as it were. So he did certainly lead the charge. His particular issue was impoverished children. And he was in Manchester, a very industrialized city at the time, to deliver a talk on child poverty. And he intended to write a pamphlet. But as he was walking around the city, he was inspired. He got this idea. Now, the finished product was a combination of influences. In an episode of the Pickwick Papers, he told the tale of Gabriel Grubb, who undergoes a transformation after being visited by goblins. So there's the seed of the idea there. And that combined with his own childhood experiences, plus the influence of Washington Irving, who believed that, you know, you should take the solemn Christmas celebration away from the Puritans and turn it into a party. Mm-hmm. The combination of all of those things resulted in A Christmas Carol. So Dickens' intent was to, he was in a bit of a career slump. So he was in some financial straits, just a bit. And so his intention was to write something that would improve the conditions of children, impoverished children, while also making him some profit.
Naturally.
Yes, of course. Unfortunately, he underestimated the cost of publication, and the story was almost immediately pirated, which is kind of unbelievable. He took a couple of publishers to court, but when he won, they just declared bankruptcy. So it took a while for him to actually see any return on the story. It was also almost immediately pirated and adapted for the stage, which makes sense because Dickens loved the theater. He married an actress. He wrote in terms of images and dialogue. So his work transferred very nicely to the stage and also to the screen and to ballet and to opera. And the BBC even had a production with Marcel Marceau in a mime production of A Christmas Carol.
That's so amazing.
Yes. So it's, you know, it's an intrinsic part of our culture now. It obviously resonates with people because it has been done again and again and over and over. In 1901, they had the first film adaptation, and it was a silent film, of course. And then six more silent versions followed the first one. And one of them was made by Thomas Edison in 1910. The first sound version was made in Britain in 1928.
Right at the very forefront of sound in film.
And ever since then, you know, everyone has had a version of it.
And, you know, it's because it's such a compelling idea that for wrongs that we've committed, we can be taken back and shown those and shown what effect they've had on people, shown what our future might look like if we continue down that path. It really is just such a compelling idea. And it's no wonder that nearly everybody wants to turn that and look at themselves in that way.
Yes. Probably, to me, one of the most more moving parts of the story is beneath the skirts of Christmas Present are the children known as Ignorance and Want. And Dickens says, you know, these are our battles that we fight every day. And ignorance is the one to be more feared. It's interesting to me that, and others have pointed this out, that what makes the difference between a happy holiday and what translates to the best holiday ever for Dickens is a giant goose and lots of presents.
Wait, so having said that, do you think Dickens is also to blame for some part of our commodification and commercialization of Christmas? Because a whole lot of Christmas stories now are based around getting things, giving things on its face, but really right. They're about getting things. Do you think he bears any responsibility for that too?
Well, I think what he had was a natural reaction to childhood drama and to suffer the kinds of need that he suffered was obviously something that never went away and never and does not. You know, the conditions of impoverishment stay with those who undergo them. And the idea that this stingy, unhappy, lonely old miser would find redemption and open his heart and his billfold, that was what Dickens was after. That was his social agenda in writing the story. He wanted to make people say, okay, here's some money. Mm-hmm. Let's do something about this. But yeah, it's sort of an unfortunate side effect. On the other hand, his depiction of the Cratchits, who have no money, they're so much happier than Scrooge, who is at home counting his money. They're making do and making the best of their bad situation. So I think what he wanted was a balance. As I said, I think that people need to believe in the possibility of change, and they need to believe in the possibility of compassion. And that's what makes this story particularly resonant in our own time.
So obviously dozens and dozens and dozens of versions of A Christmas Carol have been out there for, what, the last 170 years or so. Here it is. Tell me your very favorite version.
Okay. I'm kind of embarrassed because people have traditions. And, you know, my favorite, Albert Finney, did a musical version, which I love. And I force my family to watch it every year. I have it on DVD.
Lovely. Albert Finney's a delight.
I adore him. And some of the songs, I'm not saying that it's a great soundtrack, but I personally enjoy it very much. And I sing the songs to myself all season long.
Out of all the people who have assembled here, I would merely like to mention, if I may, that our unanimous attitude is one of lasting gratitude for what our friend has done for us tonight. And therefore, I would simply like to say, thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's the nicest thing that anyone's ever done for me. I make a double dutch, but my delight is such, I feel as if a losing war's been won for me. And if I had a flag, I'd hang me flag out to add a sort of final victory touch. But since I left me flag at home, I'll simply have to say, thank you very, very, very much.
Thank you very, very, very much.
Can I tell you mine?
Sure.
And this hopefully doesn't reflect any terrible cynicism on my part, but my very favorite version is a Blackadder Christmas Carol.
Oh.
And so Blackadder, a character created by Rowan Atkinson, his family pops up throughout history during the various series that were put on the BBC, and they're usually conniving evil characters. Now, in A Blackadder Christmas Carol, what we find is the kindest man in London, Mr. Blackadder, who gives everything away during Christmas to his greedy, greedy relatives and to everyone who's asking far too much of him, and he ends up with nothing every single Christmas. And he's visited possibly accidentally by a spirit who realizes he's made a mistake and doesn't actually need to show Mr. Blackadder anything. But Mr. Blackadder says, oh, let's see it anyway. So the spirit shows Mr. Blackadder his relatives throughout history who have succeeded by being evil and conniving. And he gets more and more excited. And by the end, he is, yes, the greediest man in London. I'm guessing a lot of you out there have your own favorite version of A Christmas Carol. Let us know what that is. Go on our Facebook page or tweet us at KMUW. And I think that'll do it for this time, Sanda. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And for KMUW, I'm Fletcher Powell.